my first guest today, Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. He's a lawyer and a former professor, and his site, FFF.org, hosts such wonderful writers as Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richman, and Anthony Gregory, and also, of course, articles by himself. And although not an anarchist like myself, he still believes in the Constitution for some reason, but always a very radical defender of individual liberty and human rights against the power of the state. It is my honor to welcome back to the show Jacob Hornberger.
Hey, it's great to be back, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
It's good to have you here. Now, I guess the reason why you're so tough on maintaining the Constitution is because compared to what we have, it would be a big improvement, no?
Well, absent the Constitution, we would be in serious trouble. I mean, as bad as things are, as bad as what the Bush administration and the Pentagon are doing to avoid the Constitution, imagine if those constraints did not exist at all. Things would be fundamentally different. In fact, we probably would be living like the Iraqi people are living today, under U.S. rule or U.S.-approved rule.
Yeah, or the people of Cuba or the people of the American base in Cuba. Is it too easy for me to make that comparison?
Well, it's,
is that a cheap shot?
It's the ultimate result of U.S. military rule. I mean, there's a specific reason that the Pentagon set up that base in Cuba, and that reason was to avoid the constraints of the Constitution of the United States, to avoid federal court interference. Their position is democracy's messy. Representative government is messy. Civilian rule is messy. Let's just set up a base here in Cuba where we don't have to deal with the courts, we don't have to deal with the Constitution, and, of course, the results we've seen, sexual perversions, tortures, I mean, things that if they had been done by some pervert, we'd be condemning it. Everyone would be condemning it. But because it's done by Pentagon officials, it's unfortunately condoned in some circles.
It kind of makes you wonder why we're enemies with Cuba. I mean, isn't that the same way Castro runs things on the other side of the fence?
That is exactly the way Castro run things. I mean, if you want to see virtually a mirror image of how two separate regimes handle terrorism, look at the Pentagon in Guantanamo and Castro in Havana. And I've traveled to Cuba. In fact, I happened to be there coincidentally when one of the terrorists was being put on trial.
Hold it right there. All right, everybody, it's a weekend interview show. We'll be right back with Jacob Hornberger. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger from the Future of Freedom Foundation. You can look him up at FFF.org. And, Jacob, I have to tell you, I was shocked, absolutely shocked, to find out that the Bush nominee to replace Sandra Day O'Connor, John Roberts, was interviewed by Bush for the job the day before the three-judge panel that Roberts sits on issued a ruling in favor of denying prisoner of war status to the men being held at Guantanamo Bay.
Oh, well, I didn't know that, but that is a horrendous decision. I mean, what it essentially says is it buys into this notion of the unlawful combatant theory of the Bush administration in the war on terrorism, which effectively gives the Pentagon the power to arrest anybody anywhere in the world and do whatever they want to him, torture, execute him, or whatever, because including Americans, by the way, because not only is the Geneva Convention doesn't apply, as the Bush administration holds, but also the Constitution and due process of law don't apply. So, and Roberts, effectively, that's the effective thrust of that decision. Now, ultimately, it might collide with the Padilla decision. Hopefully, the Fourth Circuit going to rule the other way, but we don't know because it's a very conservative court.
Okay, now you bring up the designation unlawful combatant. Now, I know that basically the current Attorney General Gonzalez advised Bush that if he made a finding in a directive that the Geneva Convention didn't apply to the enemy in Afghanistan, that is the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda network guys, the Arab Afghans, that basically, as you say, they are outside of the rule of law. But now, is there a difference in the designation between an unlawful combatant and an enemy combatant? I know that the enemy combatant was basically just made up out of whole cloth, but is an unlawful combatant, is that actually somewhere in the law or a treaty somewhere that thing exists?
No, it's created totally out of whole cloth. I mean, what we're talking about is, let's go back a step and just talk about a regular war, whether it's a legal war or an illegal war. For example, the Vietnam War, clearly an illegal war under our system of government. There was never a declaration of war required by the Constitution. And yet, it's a war, so there are enemy combatants in that war. One side is fighting another side, or World War II, the Germans fighting the Americans. What they've done is create a sham that effectively gives the government the power to arrest critics of government, dissidents, to arrest anyone. And the way they've done that is they said, well, we actually have a new war, sort of like the war on drugs or the war on poverty, the war on illiteracy. It's the war on terrorism. And the whole battleground is the earth, because on the earth there are terrorists everywhere, so including the United States. And so they're claiming the right, the power, to arrest anyone, a government critic, a dissident, or whatever, and have no federal court interference, no review, no habeas corpus, simply arrest that person, label him a terrorist with no judicial review, and execute him.
All right, well, let me try to play Cheney's advocate here and say that, well, you can't just treat him like a regular crime, because if we're talking about suicide bombers, what good is the threat of prosecuting them?
Well, ultimately, we have to figure out the roots of this terrorist, the suicide bombers and so forth. A separate issue, but I don't think it should be left aside, that the roots of what's going on in this terrorism business is U.S. foreign policy. So if you really want to get rid of the suicide bombers and the terrorists and the insurgents and so forth, you got to reevaluate foreign policy, stop the government's role as empire of the world, the world's policeman, the world's meddler, and so forth. But given that the government doesn't seem willing to relinquish its role as empire and meddler and interloper and policeman, we have to face whether terrorism is a crime or an act of war. And clearly, it has to be a crime because it's on the books. You have people being prosecuted for it. Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, I think he's the second 20th hijacker,
he's
in federal court.
Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I checked the 20th hijacker, and the Wikipedia entry has up to six different 20th hijackers. I always thought it was Ramzi bin al-Shib, but apparently you can just make up a name and say that he's the 20th hijacker at this point.
Yeah,
but I'm sorry, Moussaoui, though.
No, it's a good point, because there can't be more than one 20th hijacker. And so some of those people are innocent of that particular crime. And yet it's the Pentagon's position, we can punish them all in order to make sure we get the one. That's not what criminal justice is all about.
Right.
You also have federal criminal prosecutions of other accused terrorists. Timothy McVeigh is a good example, or the D.C. snipers, or other people that have conspired to commit terrorism against the United States. What they're doing... Now, that's all good. It's what's supposed to be the case, because terrorism is a crime. It's what Tony Blair is doing. They're prosecuting those people that are involved in those bombings. If somebody commits suicide, well, obviously, you know, you have those kind of murder suicides all the time. You cannot prosecute a dead person. Now, what they've done, though, is they've said, we are going to have the option of prosecuting them in federal court, which the Constitution requires, or simply taking them away to be executed by virtue of Pentagon custody.
And that is one of the puzzling parts about this, is there, as best I can tell, there doesn't seem to be really any rhyme or reason as to who gets turned over to the Navy, who gets turned over to the court system, who goes to Guantanamo Bay.
It is an absolute violation of the constitutional principle of equal treatment under law and the political principle of the rule of law, that people have to respond to a law, not to the arbitrary edicts of men. And this is what this is, an arbitrary edict. You are absolutely right. There is no rhyme or reason. Now, the only possible reason they may be pulling them over into the Pentagon's jurisdiction is that they lack the evidence to prosecute in a court of law.
Oh, like the Jose Padilla case, for example, you're thinking.
The Jose Padilla case or the Ali case.
Okay, wait. Now, let's hold off on Ali for a second. Let's talk about Padilla here. Because I have read in a few different places, Newsweek and MassMe, I think the New York Times, quoted FBI agents as saying, look, the fact is we don't have anything on this guy. He was supposed to be part of a dirty bomb plot, but the guy that he was supposed to be working with didn't want to have anything to do with him. He didn't have any training. He had no access to radioactive materials, no access to explosives, no bank account, and apparently they have nothing to prosecute him on. And as you're saying, that's why they turned him over to the Navy. Because he's innocent.
I think it is entirely possible that that's the case. I mean, when they had Yasser Hamdi, and I'll get back to the Padilla case in a minute, but just to make this point, when they had Yasser Hamdi in custody, they were saying that he was one of the most dangerous terrorists in history, that he had to be denied a lawyer, that he couldn't be given due process of law, that he couldn't talk to his family. And when the Supreme Court finally said, this is not what America's all about, you will give him a hearing. Guess what they did? They released him back to Saudi Arabia where he could walk the streets.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I don't think they had any evidence against him. They were holding a man they thought was guilty but could not prove his guilt.
And on top of that, this was a man who was born in Louisiana, right?
That's right. No. I don't think – yes, Hamdi was an American citizen. That's right.
They captured him in Afghanistan, but he's from Louisiana.
Absolutely right. Now, Padilla is the much more serious case as far as the American way of life is concerned. Because if the Pentagon wins the Padilla case, you are going to see a wholesale transformation in American life. It's going to be, by and large, sort of like the Pinochet regime in Argentina. Why? Because it will confirm without any question at all that the Pentagon has the right to do this, not just to foreigners. You know, Americans sort of think, oh, well, Guantanamo's for foreigners. I don't need to worry about that. Nonsense. The same principle applies to Americans, and that's what Padilla is about. They're saying in the Padilla case, we want to have the right to arrest Americans, to do what we have to do to them as suspected terrorists. And take my word for it, they will treat American terrorists much worse than they treat foreign terrorists, because an American terrorist is a traitor. But again, no federal court jurisdiction, no review. Let's say they go up and pick up a government critic. All they have to do is write a paper saying, this man's a terrorist, and that's all they need. Torture him, sexually abuse him, execute him, ship him to Guantanamo for forced interrogation, everything. That's what the stakes are in the Padilla case.
Okay, but, you know, the thing is, they're going to say every time, Jacob, that what we're going to face at some point is a guy who knows everything we need to know in order to stop a nuclear bomb from going off, and some little weasel lawyer like you is going to come and forbid them from torturing the truth out of this guy, and thousands or millions of people will die, and it'll be all your fault for insisting on your antiquated little rule of law in the face of these terribly dangerous terrorists.
Well, that's what they always say. That's what every dictatorial regime says, that it's always necessary. And in their minds, they convince themselves it's necessary. For example, when they arrested that lawyer, Mayfield, out in Oregon, in their mind, he was a guilty person. He had participated in the Madrid attacks. They were using the federal court system against him. They were going to indict him. But make no mistake about it, he was innocent. They later confessed his innocence. This is the problem, is that in their mind, they know the person's guilty. They will put him on the rack, and they will torture him until they finally figure out maybe this guy isn't guilty after all. I mean, that's what our American system has always been based on. Now, let's assume, though, worst case, that a guy does have information. Is it going to make any difference in terms of extracting the information out of him when there's 10 more behind him that are just as angry over U.S. foreign policy for what the U.S. government has done overseas? And this is why we keep arguing, Scott, at the Future of Freedom Foundation. The American people better wake up and realize that patriotism doesn't mean automatically and blindly supporting your federal government. the federal government doing some bad things to people overseas.
We'll be right back, everybody, with Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation. All right, my friends, it's the Weekend Interview Show, and I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation, relentless defender of American liberty. And you were saying before I so rudely cut you off before that last break, sir, about...
That was so rude.
Well, actually, you know, I was watching...
Make money.
I was watching the clock wrong. We still had another 10, 15 seconds. I could have let you finish your sentence. But in any case, you were talking about American foreign policy and how, yeah, okay, you can torture this guy. You might stop this attack, but all you're doing is creating the circumstances for the next one. Is that your point?
Exactly. That we have to get to the root of what's going on here. Let me give you an analogy. When Timothy McVeigh, a terrorist, attacked the federal building, what was the response to that?
Well, cover up.
Sorry?
Cover up.
Well, you know, libertarians were saying, we have to look at what motivated this guy. And the federal said, no, don't, please, whatever you do, don't look at motivation, because that will justify what he did. Well, libertarians could not let up. We said, no, focus on what motivated him. Well, what had motivated him was the federal massacre at Waco. Well, by gradually raising the conscience of the American people and the consciousness of how horrific this massacre at Waco was, you know, it was designed to liberate the children, you know, and they killed all the children. Well, that has stopped the federal government from having any more Waco massacres. And voila, there are no more Timothy McVeigh killings. The same thing needs to be done overseas. We've got to stop the government, the federal government, from doing so many bad things to people overseas, massacring them, sanctioning them, supporting brutal right-wing dictators like Saddam Hussein and Pinochet, meddling in places they shouldn't be meddling, foreign aid to corrupt regimes, to foreign regimes. This is the type of thing. We got to restore the vision of our founding father, Scott, to stop this type of empire stuff. It's corrupting. It's debilitating. Federal spending is out of control. It's time to reevaluate that, because if we do that, then we stop the terrorism, the same thing, the same reason we no longer have the Timothy McVeigh terrorism.
Well, you know, the administration got a lot of laughs last week because they announced, I guess, their focus group had come in, and they announced they were going to rename the global war on terrorism the global struggle against violent extremism, which, on one hand, I kind of liked it because... basically, it takes out the, in fact, I think this was even the spin. They said, well, when you call it a war, then that necessitates using the Marines for everything. And really, this is the professionals, I guess, talking. We'd rather use intelligence agents and cops to fight this terrorist network rather than send the Marine Corps in everywhere. And yet, at the same time, it also... is more of a vague definition of the mission, the struggle against violent extremism. I mean, that basically is licensed for more intervention in even more places. So, I don't know. On one hand, it looked like progress. On the other hand, it looked like backtracking. But then now, apparently, Bush has come and overruled the spinmeisters, and he's still calling it the global war on terror, and apparently we're going on as before.
Well, the important thing is that they always need an official enemy in order to maintain the power over people, over their money, their lives, their liberties. I mean, this is not a new trick. The Roman emperors were famous for this. Every time they'd have their foreign wars and their debased currency and so forth, they always need the official enemy to frighten people. And of course, we lived under the Cold War. The communists were coming to get us. They were under every bed. Conservatives were famous for this, calling for big government as long as the communist threat was there. Well, libertarians always said that's nonsense. Conservatives believe in big government, and if the communist threat were ever to end, they'd still favor big government. Well, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, you'll recall that people were talking about a peace dividend of downsizing the military. They should have taken advantage of that, but by and large, what they did was they found a new enemy, terrorism, Well, it's better than communism because, you know, there's no chance it's going to go anyway away soon, especially when you're out doing bad things to people overseas. And then this latest transformation, the global war on extreme violent extremism or something, I mean, that's perfect because that's never going to go away. These are the kind of shams and tricks that the American people better start waking up and recognizing. You know, President Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex. We didn't pay attention back there in the 50s. We ought to be paying attention today.
Yeah, well, and it seems, and I'm sorry to sound like such the doomsayer, but at this point, basically, they're getting away with everything. I mean, it reminds me of the bully who just punches you in the face and then says, yeah, what? What are you going to do about it? What? And every single day there's new headlines, new outrages against the Constitution, outrages against individual rights, outrages beyond description against people in foreign lands. And on any given day, the total outcry amounts to a peep.
That's essentially true, except for the fact that I think a lot of people, growing numbers of people, are starting to think. They're starting to reflect. I see more and more references to the Constitution, mostly on the Internet. People are thinking about things that our founding fathers were thinking about in 1787 when they put that thing together. They're reflecting on the principles of the Declaration. They're challenging. They're asking challenging questions about Iraq. Well, what was the business of the U.S. to go in there in the first place? You know, why did the U.S. go in there? I mean, people are asking questions. So I think this entire paradigm under which we've been operating, the empire paradigm, the socialism paradigm at home, people are starting to question.
And, you know, that really is the best thing that we have going for us, isn't it? Is that the American creed is on our side. Peace and liberty, markets, individual rights. All right, everybody, we'll be right back with Jacob Hornberger. All right, my friends, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger from the Future of Freedom Foundation. You can look him up and read what he writes at fff.org. And we're talking military tribunals and enemy combatants and the end of the rule of law as it existed to protect you from the state. And one of the things that doesn't get too much comment on this topic, I know you've brought it up before, Jacob, is the effect that all these policies have on our own troops overseas. And we're going around torturing people. How do we expect our troops to be treated in the countries where they are?
That's a good question. Let me first comment on your ending comment before the commercial about what we stand for and what we're fighting for as libertarians. You are absolutely right. And I think it's a point that needs to be made, is that this is not what America stands for or should stand for. We ought to be leading the world in terms of creating the model society of freedom here, the peaceful society, the prosperous society. This is what America is all about. This is the vision. This is our role in the human affairs. And for us to be letting the feds transform our nation into a militarist nation, an empire nation, a socialist nation, an interventionist nation, this is appalling. So, yes, at least we have the moral high ground, and we have the original principles on which this country is based on our side. You're absolutely right also to suggest about the effect that these torture and sexual perversions have with respect to the risk to our own troops. And a lot of military men have pointed this out, that if the United States abandons the moral high ground with respect to how it treats prisoners, whether they're legal or illegal or whatever, and there's going to be absolutely no moral justification for objecting when we get into a war and the other side starts doing these same things, making American soldiers disrobe, piling on each other in nakedness, having women rub their breasts against our soldiers in order to arouse them, torturing them. I mean, this is the type of thing that they've opened up the door for that can now be done. done to American soldiers, and then what's Bush or what are federal officials going to say? Where is the moral standing for saying, you better not do this, or we're really going to come after you?
Yeah, and, you know, the argument used to be, well, it's not like they have all the great rule of law like we do to prevent torture, so, you know, that sometimes they cut people's heads off and stuff, so why should we respect them? Why should we not torture them? They're like that to us.
I think John McCain put it best. He said, this is not about them. This is about us. And when you get into wars with barbarians, you don't fall to the level of the barbarian. And when you go in Star Wars with barbarians, don't think that you're going to change a barbarian. A barbarian is a barbarian. And so the mere fact that they are engaging in barbaric acts, once you fall to that level and you permit them to pull you down to that level, they have effectively won because you have become like them. I mean, the fact is the federal government, led by the Pentagon, has shamed and humiliated our country, and they've damaged our country. And they are two separate concepts. The federal government and our country are two separate concepts, and they have terribly damaged and shamed our nation.
According to a new Pew poll, I think they interviewed 17,000 people around the world, and China is now more popular than the United States.
Well, China is obviously a communist socialist country, but they're liberalizing their economy. They're permitting people to become wealthy. And what are they doing? While the United States is out invading countries, bombing countries, engaging in all this militarism, China's engaging in commerce. They're attracting students because, you know, the U.S. is putting up all these visa restrictions. They're establishing commercial relationship with nations. They're getting economically strong, much to the chagrin of U.S. officials who consider this a threat. Well, this is nonsense. This is what the American people ought to be doing. We ought to be engaging in commerce. We ought to be making friends. But in order to do that, Scott, that's the private sector. We cannot leave that up to the federal government and its PR agents because they are making things much, much worse for the American people.
You know, it's hard to see sometimes from inside the United States, and I'm not made of money. I don't go traveling around the world or anything. But in talking to friends of mine in other places around the world, like Mike in Tokyo Rogers, for example, he tells me that, you know, the average person overseas basically sees America in the role of the Soviet Union. We are Nazi Germany. We are the Russians. We are the people that everybody's scared to death of. And I think, you know, most people within, I don't know, 50 miles of me in any given direction, they would never imagine that, no matter what we did.
Well, what I've noticed about foreigners in my limited travels overseas is that they're able to do something that Americans cannot do or unable to do. And that is draw a distinction between the U.S. government and the American people. I mean, Americans tend to conflate these two concepts, that we are the government, because that's what they're taught in their public schools. You go overseas, and people will say, we love Americans. And that's always been the reaction I've had, even traveling in Cuba. The Cuban people were the nicest people to me. They knew I was an American. They knew the embargo and what the embargo has done. They knew the brutality of that embargo. And I would ask them, why are you so nice to Americans when after what our government has done to you? And their response was very revealing. They said, what responsibility do you have for what your government has done? And so when people say, we don't like America, what it's done, what they're really referring to is the federal government. But you go overseas and the private sector, American businessmen, culture groups, they love Americans, they love our money, they love our principles, they love our values. They don't like the U.S. government and what it's done to people overseas.
You think about the average Texan, for example, people within the sound of my voice in the local listening area anyway. We hate the federal government, at least when Democrats are in charge of it. So, I mean, of course, people around the world hate our federal government even more than we do. They're the ones on the real receiving end of it. Now, Waco was nothing compared to Iraq. Iraq is Waco every day.
That is what is so fascinating. That observation is so astute that people can see the horrors of what the federal government does here in this country. I mean, the drug war. The drug war is tearing our country asunder. and just ripping it apart, destroying lives, destroying families, and people can recognize that. But as soon as the federal government goes across the ocean to another country, despite the fact that it is clearly just invading a country that has never attacked the United States, never threatened to attack, killing tens of thousands of people, including women and children, the attitude is, it's our team. We have to support our team regardless of what our team is doing and why it's there. I think that's the mindset we have to break. Not only to protect our own troops who have been put in this horrible moral quandary of killing people that have nothing to do with 9/11, have never done anything bad to the United States, or die, and because of what it's doing to us as a country, as a nation. This is what we got to be thinking about, Scott.
You know, I met a guy from the Bahamas who said, he said, when I say the words Coast Guard to you, you picture a nice kid in a nice little white sailor suit, you know, maybe helping somebody whose boat is stuck or, you know, this or that. Here's what I think of when I hear Coast Guard. I think of men with black masks and machine guns rappelling out of helicopters, killing people, seizing bank accounts, stealing people's boats, stealing people's businesses, you know, literally taking, closing down banks that have some drug money in it, and, of course, taking all the money that everybody else in town had deposited in the bank as well. When they hear the words Coast Guard, they think stormtrooper. And yet, what does the average American think when you hear Coast Guard? Exactly like he said, nice little guy in a white suit who helps people when their engine goes kaput.
Well, it's interesting that you think of the Coast Guard. I think the first time anybody says Coast Guard to me, I think of them attacking defenseless refugees from communist tyranny and capturing them, kidnapping them, and cooperating with Cuban communist Coast Guard comrades, counterparts, and forcibly repatriating these people into Cuban communist tyranny. The immorality of that action is so flagrant. I mean, it almost ranks up there with the rejection of German Jews when the Franklin Roosevelt administration refused to let German Jews come into the United States.
It's
absolutely appalling.
But, Jacob, you're not trying to assert that somebody born south of Texas has natural rights, are you?
I think people have a right to cross walls, including the Berlin Wall, including the wall they're building down there on the southern border, to better their lives, improve their lives. I think immigrants are almost like God's gift to a society. They work hard. They bring vibrancy. They bring entrepreneurship. They bring energy. And they put up with so much abuse. It's really a moral tragedy as to how we're treating these people.
Well, you know, I'm surrounded all the time with arguments about how there's really nothing worse for America than all the people from Latin America coming up here and how they're just destroying our society, they're wasting all our tax dollars, they're changing our culture, and there's a lot of reactionary sentiment around immigration. Are you sure that in spite of all of that, that it's nothing but a benefit?
There's no question it's nothing but a benefit. But, you know, there's always been this anti-immigrant fervor. I mean, there was that fervor against the Irish and against the Germans and against the Italians and so forth. But by and large, Americans believed in immigration. They believed in open borders. That's why there were no restrictions, including on our southern border. I mean, I grew up in what was a part of the northern part of Mexico that the United States had taken from Mexico some 150 or whatever years ago. And 95%, if not more, of our community was Hispanic. There wasn't any great tragedy. There still isn't. If you want to go down to a nice community, except for the drug war that's turning it apart, you can go down to Laredo, Texas. You'll see nothing but Hispanics there. It's a beautiful, wonderful community, except for the drug war, which has turned it apart. So, yeah, there's nothing to fear. Look what they've done, Scott. They've reversed the whole paradigm on which America was based. They've unleashed the federal government to go abroad and do its dirty deeds, and they're trying to isolate the American people from foreigners, building walls and harassment of immigrants and visa restrictions. It ought to be the other way around. We ought to be reining in the federal government, bringing it home, discharging the troops, unleashing the American people, the private sector, to do their wonderful deeds all around the world.
Yeah, and, you know, my favorite argument, too, about the, well, they're bankrupting us with all the Mexicans down at the hospital getting their free health care. And my answer to that is always, well, if you don't like it, then stop being a socialist. Because the fact is, we are the ones responsible for our government. I'm actually happy that people overseas don't understand that fact. But it is our responsibility to make our country not a socialist one. I don't think that Mexicans have a right to my paycheck, but that doesn't mean I got a right to point a gun at them and keep them out either.
No, what they've tried to do is confuse two different things. They've created a socialist system, both Democrats and Republicans. They're proud of it. They fight for it. It's called Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security and so forth, and they're just scared to death that somebody's going to come and suck off the system. Well, the fact is, your standard immigrant is so scared that anybody's going to find out who he is that the last thing he's going to do is try to get on some Medicare and Medicaid thing. Do they get sick? Of course they get sick. But, you know, doctors and hospitals would be more than willing to give free treatment. I mean, they did when I was growing up. I grew up in the poorest city in the United States, Laredo, and doctors gave free treatment all the time. No questions asked, because they were making a lot of money off the wealthier people in the community. That's the way the system should be working. And you're right. We ought to be junking this Medicare and Medicaid, the socialist system, and then leave people free to give free services to whomever they want to.
You know, the subject has come up on the show a couple of times about the reason why immigration, they call it illegal immigration, really only because there's a law against it, not because there's anything necessarily criminal about it. But they criminalize the immigration, but they don't really enforce it. And so what this seems to do is it creates a whole class of people who they're going to come to fill the, you know, there's a demand for their labor. So they will come to fill that demand, but they're outside of the protection of the rule of law. Like you said, they're too scared to go file for Medicaid. They're also too scared to call 911 if somebody is trying to hurt them, too. And so you basically have an entire class of people who are welcome, wink, but are outside of the protection of the law and are there just to be taken advantage of.
That is a brilliant observation. They are scared to death, these people. They have to put up with so much. The reason employers stiff them on wages is because they know they can't go and report the employer or file suit against the employer. They have to try to circumvent the Border Patrol, so they're dying on the deserts. Their families get separated. And the irony of all this is that the anti-immigrant people end up with the exact opposite result they want, because the immigrant tends to stay here permanently because he's so scared to go back home because he won't be able to get back in again. So it's an entirely perverse system. And you're right. You create this whole subclass of illegal people and also the employers, you see, because somebody's hiring these 10 million illegals. And so the employers are kept down because they know that if they make waves with the federal government, maybe like on foreign policy, objecting to what the government's doing, the subtle threat is always there. We can send the Border Patrol or the Immigration Service into your business in order to start checking papers and possibly indict you like they indicted the Tyson's chicken folks.
Yeah, and you know, that's the solution that I hear proposed more and more is, well, you know, they ought to just leave these poor illegals alone. What they need to do is go after these businessmen who keep hiring them. That's the real problem.
Yeah, well, you see, when I was growing up, it wasn't illegal to hire illegal aliens. And so we hired them on our farms, hardest working people you've ever seen on our farm. And yet today, they said, well, if you pass this law, this will solve the problem. Well, Scott, it didn't solve the problem, but that's what it is. They've got a hammer over the head of every American businessman that happens to be hiring a darker-skinned person that speaks with a Spanish accent. And that hammer is, we will indict you if you get out of line. We will come and check your workers. Well, somebody's hiring those 10 million people, and it's American businessmen that are doing the hiring.
All right. Hey, Jacob, spend the next minute or so telling me about the Future Freedom Foundation. Then we got to go out to this break and come back and talk a little bit more about the tribunals.
Well, we were founded 15 years ago, 1989. Our mission is to present an uncompromising case for individual liberty, free markets, limited government, a republic, the vision of our founding fathers, what the Constitution really means, the Declaration of Independence. We've got a very, very active website, fff.org. We've got a daily free email update. Goes out to anyone that wants to subscribe. every single day.
Awesome. And also, some of your writers, Jim Bovard, Sheldon Richmond, Anthony Gregory. Who am I leaving out?
Let's see. Well, I think that's pretty much it. We link to a lot of people.
Oh, hold it right there. All right. We'll be right back, everybody, with Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. Welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Jacob Hornberger from the Future Freedom Foundation. And, you know, here we're way off topic here. My problem is I just love talking about how much I love Mexicans and how I wish they would all come to the United States. Seeing how they're all individuals and all have the right to go wherever they want, why not come here and buy property and live in my neighborhood? And I love talking about that on the radio, but the real reason I brought you on here is to talk about these military tribunals and the destruction of the Bill of Rights, and so forth. And there's a big scandal broken out recently here. Now, it's pretty obvious why defense lawyers would be mad, but the military prosecutors for these military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay are complaining. I have a quote here from John Carr. He's a captain in the U.S. Air Force. He was going to be a prosecutor for one of these military tribunals. And the quote here from the New York Times, quote, "I expected there would be at least a minimal effort to establish a fair process." And he went on and on like that about how this is a total sham. It's such a kangaroo court. He cannot abide taking part in it. And so he resigned his position as a prosecutor. And a couple more now have followed in his footsteps. What the hell is going on here, Jacob?
Oh, well, it's a great point you made. First of all, you caught me off guard from my other question. Let me add the other people that write for us.
Right. Oh, yeah, do that. I don't want to sell them short.
At the Future Freedom Foundation. Of course, there's Scott McPherson. There's Doug Van there. There's Wendy McElroy, George Leaf, Bart Frazier, Anthony Gregory, on top of the others that you mentioned, Bovard and Sheldon and so. And they all do great work. And so I wanted to make sure anything that we've accomplished is because of them, because they're just great writers. They're uncompromising and they're really moving our country in a better direction.
Yeah, you got that right. And I got to recommend that. It's FFF.org. And I don't know if you still have this problem, but there used to be a problem where you have to put in the three W's. I don't know if you've gotten that fixed, but it's FFF.org. And I second that. Bovard, Richmond, Gregory, and Hornberger himself and the rest of them. Excellent stuff to read at FFF.org. Okay, now, sorry.
Thank you, Scott. Well, yes, it's great to see that there's still people in the military that are willing to take a stand against their superiors, because unfortunately many military men are just going to obey orders. They're going to be sycophants. They're going to try to please their superiors. These prosecutors are an example of an honorable and respectable military man. They've stood up against these tribunals. They disclosed that what they're doing is they're rigging them, which is what we've been arguing, Scott, from the very beginning when they first proposed these. They're rigging the result in order to get a guilty conviction, and then they can go ahead and execute them. It's no different from what the Soviet Union was doing with those kangaroo courts that they had. They execute a guy, but they put it all in legal jargon and legal proceedings. Well, it's all rigged. And as you know, the criminal defense bar is boycotting those things totally, because they felt that participating in them would give them credibility. These things are a sham. They're a disgrace. The reason they're in Cuba is because the Pentagon holds our Constitution in contempt. What they ought to do is they ought to bring all those prisoners to the United States. If they've committed crimes, indict them. If they can't indict them, if they lack the evidence, then release them. That's what America's all about. We're not the Soviet Union.
And you're speaking as a lawyer and a former officer in the U.S. military, correct?
That's right. I'm a former infantry officer. I spent 8 years in the reserves. I'm a graduate of Virginia Military Institute, and I practiced law as a litigator for some 12 years.
Well, there you go. And let's see, there's more here, but I don't know how much more we can get into without having to start a whole new topic. I guess still maybe we can just reiterate the point that these men being held at Guantanamo Bay, our government has called these men over and over again the worst of the worst. That's why they're there, is because they're terrorists, and they'd be killing you if we didn't have them locked in a cage right now.
It's time to not only close that thing down and not send these people off to some foreign jails, try them or release them, and then just give that imperial base back to Cuba. It belongs to Cuba. The United States has no business owning these imperial locations. Well, just close it down permanently, relinquish ownership of it.
FFF.org.